Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey out there, everyone. Phil here. Before we get started, I just want to have a quick chat to you. Recently, Rolltocast was nominated in the Australian Podcast Awards. We're up for the Best Fiction Podcast, but there's also a Listener's Choice Award, and we'd love for you to give us a hand getting up the charts in the Listener's Choice Award. So all you have to do is go to australianpodcastawards.com/vote, type in Rolltocast, and you'll see us come up and pop your vote in. That would be really, really appreciated. And if you want to support what we're doing, please, please head to our Patreon. That is patreon.com/babybeard. You have lots of benefits there, including getting on our Discord and our monthly stream that we do as well. That happens at the end of every month. Get involved with that too. But I won't keep you too long. Please enjoy the show.
Welcome, everybody, to Rolltocast, the now award-nominated tabletop RPG podcast of both actual plays and interviews with the creators. I am Ellen, and I have been the GM of our latest season, Kids on Bikes, A Mystery Down Under, and I am joined here at the Baby Beard table by...
Phil! Hello! I played Jono in this last season.
You sure did, and following the post-Kids on Bikes wrap-up episode from last week, oh, it was very good, wasn't it? Very informative, very funny. We haven't recorded it yet. we're following our inter-season content with the two creators of Kids on Bikes. Would you like to introduce yourselves, Doug Lewandowski and Jonathan Gilmore? Boo, boo, boo.
I'd be happy to. I'm Doug Lewandowski. I'm one of the co-creators of Kids on Bikes, Teens in Space, Kids on Brooms, other things. Yeah, I'm thrilled to be here from a very, very different time zone.
Thank you. We're very, very happy to have you join us. And
yeah, thank you.
Jonathan.
I'm Jonathan Gilmore. I co-designed those themes with Doug Lewandowski as well. And it's very early.
We're just so, Josh, to have both of you here with your whole expanding Kids On franchise. And I know that you both met at a convention together, Metacon. What was the kind of little chatette that you had?
That was quite a while ago, right? Metatopia, I believe, was maybe the first time that we met up, which is a smaller playtesting convention here in the U.S. I think Doug and I just kind of really hit it off, like, as well, like, as far as working on projects. Yeah. We just, you know, really liked each other's design style and wanted to do something together.
So what had you previously made, each of you, when you first met?
When we first met? Gosh, I don't know if I had anything published yet.
You did. You had Gothic Doctor out.
Remembering each other's histories.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, Doug.
What's that?
Oh, it's just, it's very sweet that you obviously know each other very well, know each other's working histories.
Yes.
I was reading a little bit about, you know, talking about your styles of collaboration. And I think it was you, Jonathan, that said harshest critique is the only kind of critique. And, you know, you want someone who will really kind of give you the criticism and help you become better as a game designer. Is that how you kind of work together as a partnership? Like, what makes you two such a dynamic duo?
I think we have a really good working relationship where we're both really honest with each other when it comes to feedback like that. And neither one of us is, you know, too bashful to tell the other one when an idea is bad, which is what I really like. What about you, Doug?
Yeah, and I think the flip side to that that makes that work is that at this point in our designing careers, I know when I was first starting, I was pretty fragile about design stuff. But at this point, I'm wedded to almost nothing in the design process. And that, I think, helps the critiques go better. It's really few and far between when, like, I get feedback from John about something that I'm, like, upset about it, even if it was something that I really, really liked. I think the magic system in Kids on Brooms might be the last one that, like, that I remember thinking, like, wow, that doesn't feel great. But in the end, it was, you know, much for the better. I banged out a draft of that, and the numbers were just way too high. Like, magic would have been like, you may as well try to lift the boulder with your bare hands. And John and Spencer were like, well, you know how magic is the fun thing? Maybe people should do the fun thing. I was like, I don't know. Maybe it's hard to lift a boulder, guys.
So are you, Doug, more of the realist? Try to keep this whole thing grounded, like a boulder, you might say.
Right, right, right. I'm like, hey, guys, why don't we have, like, verisimilitude in games that people play for escapism? Wouldn't that be fun?
Oh, goodness gracious.
But no, I mean, I think that balance works well. I think it's good that both of us are, you know, come in with the ideas we come in with thinking, this is a really good idea, right? We're not, you know, presenting drafts of absolute garbage to the other one, right? And then saying, like, okay, but now what do I think is good in here that's not good? And the ability to be honest with each other, like John said, and to be, you know, loving harsh critics of each other, I think
is great.
It makes the game stronger as a result. And obviously, you know, once you've got a good working relationship, you can move on from doing the old the shit sandwich, as I like to do. Do you guys use the shit sandwich?
The compliment sandwich, yeah. They call it. Yeah.
See,
the shit sandwich is something else. Yeah,
yeah. Phil focuses on the compliment bread, and I focus on the shit filling. Meat filling.
Now, I wanted to ask about the Kids On is sort of growing into its own sort of thing at the moment. The games sort of share a DNA, particularly around those kind of stats that all the characters have. Was that hard to come up with or hone down onto what you thought the kind of six key storytelling attributes were? How did you arrive at those particular six?
Well, I mean, that's really a direct result of kind of the thing that we're talking about. Because when we first started having the conversation, Doug had posted to Facebook. He's like, hey, does anybody want to make a Stranger Things board game?
Mm.
And I got a message and I was like, hey, I'm already working on a board game. What if we did an RPG? So we started having the conversations, you know, about Kids on Bikes. And Doug was like, well, we really need to make it feel like old school D&D in some way. Like, because that's an important thing in the show. And we kind of want that, like, nostalgic element of D&D. And he was like, what if we used Thaco?
I've got no idea what that means.
it's the most infamous and strange mechanic from early D&D.
Is that with the armor class?
Yes.
And how you, like, get rid of it the more powered.
Oh, and you have to use a table, right,
to hit armor class zero.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like decent level math that you have to do to do anything. And I immediately was like, well, that's awful. What if we don't do that instead? I don't remember. One of us was like, well, what if we just use, you know, a full set of polyhedrals for the stats and like make it feel like it's your D&D character in a different way?
And I love you both for that, because I love indie TTRPGs and I love, you know, ones that use different mechanics, but I am sick of not being able to use all of the dice in my collection. I bought all of these 7 dice and I want to freaking use them. So Kids on Bikes, like when right. I found this game, it was just such a mwah for all of the dice goblins out there.
And then the other part of that was our initial thinking after watching the first season of Stranger Things was how much, and I think the later seasons got away from this a bit, but how much that first season was about dualism, right? The focus on the upside down being a sort of inversion of the real world. Mm. And so all of the stats are inversions of the other one, right? Yeah. Like fight and flight, brains and brawn, charm and grit. And our initial thinking was that if you had a D20 in one, you'd have a D4 in the other. And if you had a D12 in one, you would have a D6 in the other. So your brains and your brawn would always be opposite each other.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
And eventually we moved away from that to give people more freedom and sort of flesh out the tropes a little bit.
Yeah, and you can break out from the archetypes a little bit. You can have a guy who's brainy,
right?
But, you know, is still up for that scholarship.
Mm.
Yeah. It's a sports scholarship.
Yeah, that was definitely a darling that Doug had to kill for me, because I really liked the high-low system. And we even took it a step farther, because we were like, well, we kind of wanted to introduce some board gamey elements to it as well, because we're both board game designers and we both love board games and RPGs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we had like these tiles that were opposed to each other that you would print out and put on your character sheet instead of actually. And I think Dud was like, well, what if we just directly put the dice on there and let them do whatever? And I was like, yeah, that's brilliant. Like,
you've done it.
I forgot about the tiles.
There are so many little cool things in Kids on Bikes that are really simple and allow for kind of role players of any experience to kind of come to it. And I think the thing that just twigged in my head was the backpack of what would your character have in a backpack. And it was such a simple thing to ask in terms of character creation, but it really does add into that thing of allowing people to feel more comfortable in immersion and immersive role playing, which I think is really fantastic about Kids on Bikes.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. We very much wanted to make it approachable for people who were new to role playing games, because another part of the conversation we had was that we felt like most RPGs don't really teach you how to play.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I played D&D as a teenager, but like picking up second edition D&D books, they don't teach you how to play D&D at all. Like, it's a list of rules, but right. You really need like somebody experienced to show you the first time.
It's something I'm seeing more and more in books, actually, is a kind of like, okay, so how does this whole role-playing thing work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How to not be a jerk at your table.
Yeah.
Well, and it was even that we wanted to try to incorporate that into the mechanics. So just people answering questions from their character's perspective during the character creation is like a really good way to teach people to step into that role and, you know, start saying, I do this rather than, you know, my character does this.
Yeah. I mean, the role playing for your game. So the role playing really starts before the story does, where you're answering questions about the setting, you're answering questions about your character's relationship to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's that for me is it's really interesting to hear you guys talk about it as nearly being a board game, when I feel like that's such a wonderfully role-playing centric kind of beginning to Kids on Bikes group.
Kids on Pikes Kids is on the Pikes. Medieval setting.
Yeah, that's right. Oh no. Oh no.
Well, write it down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I get a credit?
Yeah, you get 1% for coming up with the name.
Was there a point where it moved away from that board game idea and you guys really lent into turning it into a sort of immersive role-playing game?
I mean, I think it was always, John was already working on the board game, right? And that eventually became Snallygaster, right, John?
Yep, that was. And that was actually where I had come up with the name Kids on Bikes.
Right.
And I just talked to my board game co-designer, and I was like, hey, we're going to steal that name for the RPG too. Is that all right? And he was like, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, wow. What a lovely partner that you have.
But yeah, so it was always that there were the board game elements to it more than, you know, we weren't going to have a board or, you know, the sort of physical play space.
Yeah.
The intent was always to make it that immersive role-playing game, but incorporate the good elements from board games that we love to supplement that and to reinforce that.
Yeah, like another element of that is the skills in Kids on Bikes. Like when we were talking about making these skills, in most RPGs, like if you swim, you just like get +1 to your swimming.
Right.
We were like, we want like all the skills to just have like mechanical uses in the game. Much more, sorry about that. That was my wake up alarm.
Are you awake?
Barely. Yeah, so we wanted all the abilities to have mechanical hooks in the game and not just be like, you do this just a little bit better.
Right, and the sort of like the adversity token economy there, I think, is a more board gamey kind of mechanic, right? Like weighing how much you want to do this thing now and the counterbalance of like, but if I spend the adversity tokens for this, I won't have them for that.
Well, I find that really interesting you say that, because I know that you, Doug, you taught English.
Yeah.
And I looked at the adversity token mechanic and I always saw it as a way of kind of parceling out story beats, as a way of sort of emulating the ebb and flow of a story of you know, the low point resulting in kind of triumph later down the line. So I thought it was a way to sort of make the mechanics and the story align in that way, rather than be sort of a board game kind of currency, I guess. So did you bring any of your thinking from that part of your life into the design?
I mean, that sounds a lot smarter. We can
you can use that.
Yeah, you can say that later.
We can actually, maybe our editor is good enough to somehow modulate your voice.
So that sounds like your idea.
Yeah.
Well, I can repeat it. As an English teacher. So, I mean, I think we had definitely talked about the notion of fail forward, which I think is like a sort of boiled down version of that, where failure should still feel fun in a game. Like everything you do should be fun, even if it's not fun for your character. And so working that in and giving that bonus for failure was a big part of it. And so, you know, I don't know if that intuitively was, you know, the sort of like, well, the hero has to fail before they fly, but maybe we'll go with it. Sure.
It is such a wonderful way of making players feel really excited. And I think the adversity tokens, certainly from our experience, led into that sense of this should be a collaborative and cooperative game where people are looking to spend adversity tokens to help their friend, or you know, obviously the mechanic of the powered character is kind of everyone is collaboratively working at the table to accomplish a goal.
Mm-hmm.
We even had I think it was you, Phil, who bemoaned that you hadn't failed anything.
Yeah.
So you had no adversity tokens to spend.
Well, I built a young protector, right? A young provider. So my whole thing was like helping other people. So I was like, I need to fail so I can start handing out tokens.
Do you find that there was a big focus on making this a real collaborative game? And was that inspired by the genre, by what kind of game that you wanted to make? What was the ethos towards let's make the role playing really cooperative?
It was, because I think I said early on, or one of the, I don't remember who, at this point, I don't remember who said most of the things in our design. but one of us said that we wanted the power of characters in there, and I remember the other one distinctly saying, then everybody's just going to be power characters all the time. So we were like, well, how do we implement in a way that's impactful but doesn't just unbalance the game? Make it not fun. Because if everybody had powers, it would be a lot less. less stakes, I think. So that's when we started to dream up the idea of like co-controlling that character, and what would that look like.
But it fits so neatly onto the some of the things that are kind of quite clearly influences for the game. You know, off the top of my head, you know, you've mentioned Stranger Things, but like, you know, E.T. is also your powered character. Yeah. You know, whose mm-hmm. abilities are revealed, you know, piecemeal during the story. So it maps really well onto those. So form and function, I feel like, work really well there.
Yeah. We kind of had this list of touchstones, like Goonies, E.T., Stranger Things, like we Paper Girls, the comic book.
I knew that you had mentioned Paper Girls in previous interviews. I was hoping it would come up. It's one of my favorite comic books. No one else has read it in this freaking household. I'm sick of not being able to talk to it. So I just wanted to say thank you very much. I feel validated. I feel seen.
Just start following your housemates around and holding it in front of them until they read it, because they have to.
I have tried, it's so good. But I only have two hands. And I'm trying to get them onto The Wicked and The Divine and so many other comics at the same time. They're all a bit sick of me.
But and I think actually in terms of the collaborative storytelling, that's actually a part where the English teacher in me, I think, did come into it. One of the things that people have complained is probably too strong a word, but one of the things that some people have had issues with is the amount of creativity that it expects from the players and the GM. You know, it's less of a, I think of role-playing games as a, what you're creating is the framework for people to tell their story. And the framework can either help support them in telling their story, or it can get in the way of them telling their story. In my work with high school students, like, I've seen the ability to be creative, the ability to do things on their own that I think, if I had grown up and been a lawyer, I wouldn't have seen and wouldn't have expected that people would be able to do. And then if I was somehow both a game designer and a lawyer,
you perhaps wouldn't have had those elements to it, where the kind of right. freedom. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And sorry, I sort of trailed off there because I started staring into the void of what life would be like if I were a lawyer.
Fair.
It's not too late.
One of my best friends who's known me since high school, we were talking about, you know, like alternate versions of ourselves. And I said, yeah, like I think there's an alternate version of you where this, this, and this. Do you ever think about how, like there's an alternate version of me where I'm a lawyer? And he said, yes, as infrequently as possible. but anyway, but yeah, I think creating that framework, right? Like I want games that I work on to be sort of like a set of storytelling prompts that at the end you have this thing that you've created with your friends, with the table, that is this almost like living, breathing thing, like any great story.
I was surprised that, I mean, being game designers and knowing narratives very well kind of goes hand in hand with making role-playing games, but I was surprised that there was no kind of acting background, because this whole game is very, very good for yes and.
It's very theater kids.
Yeah, the idea of, okay, you turn a corner and you see something. What is it that frightens you so much? And just totally giving the control to the players and then back to the GM and just kind of handballing it around is very, as you say, Phil, theater kid.
Yeah.
Well, I did get a C+ in improv in high school.
Not great so improv.
I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but maybe.
I think so. We can't rule it out, certainly. Speaking of not ruling things out, the other mechanic I find so, so, so exciting in Kids on Bikes is the rumors. Everyone adding rumors to the game and figuring out which rumors will pay off, which are red herrings and what have you. What is the weirdest rumor that you've been able to kind of pay off in Kids of Bikes? Or have you heard tell of anyone coming back to you and be like, I can't believe a player dropped this early on and I managed somehow to pull the whole thing off?
Let me think. I mean, I love seeing people post those things in the forum, because they're always, I'm a very lazy and bad GM. So mine, and that's why like a lot of the world creation stuff is in there, because like I don't like to come up with ideas as the GM. I'm like, let's just make the players do all the work. and Dad was like, well, what if we frame it in a more positive way where it's collaborative? And I was like, yeah, whatever. As long as I don't have to have ideas.
As long as I don't have to do it, that's fine.
I don't know. So Doug and I have this thing, like whenever we sign the books, we always write half a story prompt in it. And I always write a rumor. And Doug, what is it that you always write?
I always write a powered character in there.
Yeah.
Right? Oh.
Like, did you hear that old lady Jenkins' new cat was, you know, was seen lighting a dog on fire or whatever?
I did know. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, everybody who's cool knows.
And I heard that she's that way from the war.
Uh-huh. That's right. That cat's seen some shit.
So you see, you know, you've had a lot of, you get a lot of response and stuff on the forums. How has the response been for the game? Obviously, you're now expanding it into other areas. It's got some legs to it. Was that something you expected, or has it been a pleasant surprise?
I think it's been a pleasant surprise for me very much. Oh. Like, Doug and I just started it as like a little passion project that we were going to kickstart ourselves.
Yep.
And it was very happenstance that I, at Gen Con, like we had already started to get Heather to do the artwork, and we were doing the, you know, we had the cover, we had five or six internal pieces, and we were starting to put together the Kickstarter ourselves. And I just, at Gen Con, I was going from one meeting to the next, and I ran into Ivan Van Norman, who I'd known online for a couple of years, but never met in person. And I was like, oh shit, you're Ivan. I wanted to say hi. And he was like, well, you know, he was at his booth, and you know, we talked for a few minutes. He's like, what are you working on? And I was like, well, let me show you this RPG real quick, because I knew that was, you know, his specialty is RPGs, and he really loves them, doing Outbreak Undead. And I showed him this, and he like put his hand over top of my phone. He's like, don't show this to anybody else.
Dibs.
We're going to take you to the, your name's going to be in lights, kid.
Yeah. But he was like, let's talk about what we could do with this after the convention. So that's, you know, totally randomly that happened. And A, neither Doug or I wanted to publish it ourselves. Like, we were just going to do it because it was the path of least resistance. And yep. Yeah, we didn't know anything about, like, neither of us had published an RPG before, so we didn't know publishers like we do in the board game industry. And we were like, you know, maybe the RPG will do, you know, a couple thousand, and we'll get a nice meal out of this, and we'll make this fun thing. And then it just kind of took off, and the community around it, like, really blossomed. People doing podcasts and, you know, all those things. It's been incredible.
Yeah, I hear it even made it to Australia. So weird.
Yeah. All the way around the world. It's wild.
I mean, that was my goal. Was to penetrate that market.
It's a hard one. You've got to get through all the kangaroos, all the wombats, and you finally make it to the.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Nerds, why do you think? I mean, it's hard to measure why something would be successful. Obviously, if you're working on it, you have a whole lot of passion for it, and you think it's, you know, the best thing that it's going to be. But why do you think the Kids On franchise has just blossomed, and now you're kind of, you know, teens in space and kids on brooms and who knows what else? What do you think has been the kind of thing that's really caught in people's hearts.
I think that is that people just want to tell fun stories, and the less hurdles there are to do that, the better.
Right.
And I think that we stumbled on a system that just makes it really easy to tell fun stories.
So you feel it's the simplicity of it, the you can pick it up and there's not too much in the way, but there's enough for you to hang on to?
I think so. I think making it really approachable for new players was a big big part of that.
Well, I can tell from firsthand experience, it made it very, very wonderfully tantalizing in terms of, this was the first game I had ever run.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, oh, wow. Yeah. So, and I did it on a podcast too for everyone to hear. Yay!
Nailed it.
Thank you. But knowing that it was such a narrative focused and simple kind of mechanics that I could really get my head around and just, as you said, focus on the story, really made it super easy and super fun for me to dive in, even though I was not so confident on running a game. So yeah, you can take that to the bank.
But the other part about it, and the other thing that has kind of persisted, you know, is this kids or this teens part, you know, that's kind of independent of the mechanics. I mean, you could take, say, those six different dice mechanics and those six stats and you know, apply them to sort of an adult-centric game. Do you think there's something in the kind of freedom of playing some more naive or more innocent characters that means you kind of stuck with the kind of kids' idea? Is there something there?
I mean, I think that automatically gets people to shift more into the playing a role space, right? Like, I know when I play D&D, the same friend who tries to think as little as possible about me being a lawyer, is also my GM. And one of his running jokes with me is like, all right, so Doug's going to play Doug in this game. But, is it going to be Doug the Paladin or Doug the Bar? Which one? It's one of those two. I think with playing a kid, you're automatically not playing yourself, right? You're necessarily shifting back to that earlier space where you didn't know as much, where you saw the world differently, and I think that just requires players to look back and say, okay, well, what mistakes did I make when I was younger, right? Like, how was I thinking about the world differently, more simplistically, more black and white, more whatever, and how can I bring that into my character?
We've all been kids, right?
Not I.
Yeah.
Never once. That's a really, really interesting thing that you mentioned about thinking back to when we're kids and having to put ourselves in those shoes. There's a really interesting thing in the game about fear and how, you know, when the older we get, our fears become a lot more specific of, you know, death and being alone and taxes and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's mentioned in the book that sometimes kids are scared of what's under their bed or spiders or, you know, kind of I just remember reading that and thinking, oh, this is a really good reminder to role play and to put yourself in the shoes of someone who's a bit more innocent and who has fears that are a bit more tangible and not irrational, but
immediate.
And then the fear there for other things becomes so much more nefarious. The opportunity for horror and mystery is a lot scarier because you think of, you know, kids trying to go up against a big government scheme or something like that. And it really lends into higher stakes, I find.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, Freud's theory about the Unheimlich is to dip into the English teacher thing for as briefly as I possibly can, is the...
I'll allow it.
His theory about fear and horror is that it returns us to that earlier psychic state, right? And so the things that frightened us as children frighten us to some extent as adults, right? Even if it's not, well, I can't possibly go down into that dark basement, it's, there's no good reason for me to not want to go down into the basement, but boy howdy, I don't.
Fuck that dark basement. I'm still not going there.
I don't know if you've all seen the new Candyman movie, but
I have. Oh, it's so good.
It's so good. But that scene where, not to give anything away, one of the characters opens a door, looks down, and there's this rickety staircase into a dark basement and says, hell no, and closes the door.
Right? Truly a horror movie for our times.
I think it's just nope, right? Looks and says nope, and closes the door, and that's it.
But something that's so nice about, so interesting, I think, about something like Stranger Things is that those childhood fears are given, they're given real stakes. They become, that you know, the kids are not believed, but for them the fears are actually very, very real. And I think that inversion is something that's really fun to play with in a story.
Speaking of the mechanics allowing you to tell those kind of stories, or you know, allow the freedom for people to really tap into the role playing and tell a story that's a lot more collaborative, what kind of stories do you guys like to tell?
Oh, my favorite is just exploring the weird stuff that my players come up with. Like, I really like seeing the weird directions that they take it in. So I'm really happy to explore anything. I love running it at conventions and doing one-offs because you get such a weird mix of random people who don't play together all the time and who bounce off like weird energies off from each other, which is a lot of fun. So I always like the really weird stories that happen then.
You like mashups.
Yeah.
What about you, Doug? What's your favorite kind of story?
I love longer form stuff. And I love it when either the GM or one of the players brings back something from earlier that didn't seem important at the time. But then comes back. Or, I mean, one of my favorite things to do, and before when you asked about rumors, I was trying to think of an example of this. When one of the rumors gets inverted, right? Like, oh yeah. So one of my favorite rumors, remember how I said I love callbacks?
oh, he's just done one in our podcast.
Was that it was a game at a convention, but it was the rumor that the principal was actually devouring children, which, like, you know, in terms of being afraid of your principal when you're a kid, like, was great for all of that. So the setup for the story was that, like, it was the Breakfast Club. They were all at a Saturday detention, but it was Saturday night. And so as it was getting dark out there, they started hearing things, and they were, you know, the principal had told them, do not leave the library. Do not. And they started hearing things out in the hallway and snuck out and saw this figure rushing towards them and ran back in and slammed the door, locked it, and were trying to keep it closed as somebody was trying to break in. And then everything went quiet and they stepped away from the door and the principal's body got flung through the door, totally destroyed. Oh, and then the creature showed up.
They locked him out. Around,
right. Like flipping it around where the thing that they're expecting that they've built up in their heads as part of that process of the rumors, or that, you know, the players are very clearly moving in this direction, and then inverting it and having that moment of like surprise at the table is one of my favorite things, as long as it all makes sense. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
You know where my mind immediately went? Not that the principal was fine. It's that the principal was actually all those monsters stacked inside of a trench coat. Oh, wow. I'm
we know what your next story is.
Yeah. I feel really bad. I didn't do that now. I had the perfect opportunity. I let it slip through my fingers.
I've seen recently you guys are doing some sort of live stream design stuff for kids in capes.
Yes.
What was the idea behind that, and how's that all going?
So the idea to live stream it was Dud. So he was like, "Hey, would it be dope if we like design this with a bunch of other people and did it all live, where people could, you know, watch the process?" Because it's a thing we get asked a lot. And the superhero thing was me beating Dud up, since we've been working on Kids on Bikes, to do a superhero game, And I finally got him to watch Stargirl, the DC TV show. And I was like, kid, Dud was like, no, Kids on Bikes isn't superheroes. Like, that doesn't work. There's a million other really good superhero games. Masks exist. There's no reason for us to do Kids on Bikes. And I was like, just watch Stargirl. Stargirl is Kids on Bikes superhero team. And he watched it and he was like, all right, yeah, we'll do superheroes next. You're right.
I'm sensing a pattern here in your working relationship.
Well, it's good to have your minds changed.
It's just one of us bullying the other one into doing something.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Does it affect the design process much to know that you have an audience while you're doing it? Or do you find you just sort of forget that and just go?
I found it had a pretty big impact. Mostly positively.
I mean, Austin was really smart helping us set boundaries from the start and to, you know, kind of say like, hey, listen, we're doing this to interact with everybody. But like, you know, feel free to chat however you want in the chat, but you know, we're going to be very careful about like not coming to the audience for ideas. We want to show you the design process, but we don't want to like design a weird audience camel.
A beautiful corpse made by chat. Yeah.
Right. Yes. I was very unsure about the metaphor we were striking here. Kids in camels? Is that going to be the next?
No, the old jeans saying is that a camel is a horse designed by a committee.
Right. I hadn't heard that one.
No, I've never heard of that either.
I think that's it, isn't it, Doug?
Yeah.
What's a platypus then? Oh, God. Someone really ballsed up.
A platypus is a duck designed by a committee on acid.
Yeah. I was going to say it was, you know, it's a committee on like Friday at 4 p.m., you know.
Yeah. Dad at the pub.
They're just ready to go home.
All right, lads. lads.
On its heels. Fuck it. Yeah, great. We're going home.
I feel like the platypus is giving the customer what they asked for.
Yeah. Oh, God. Speaking of working as game designers, you're both freelance, and I feel like we can definitely empathize as both kind of jobbing creatives and actors and all that kind of business. What is the kind of working life and as a freelance when you're kind of looking for new projects, trying to get things crowdfunded? How do you kind of manage all of that? And for you, Doug, being a teacher on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, John and I have totally different approaches. John's full-time with game design and I am emphatically part-time.
Adamantly, so, I would even say.
Yeah. I had an intern who was a game design student at a college that where a friend of mine teaches. And in our first meeting, the kid said, so when did you know you wanted to be a full-time game designer? And I said, I'm not.
And I don't.
Like, if that's the internship opportunity you're looking for, I will help you find someone, but I am not. He was like, oh, but you're planning on being full-time at some point, right? I was like, no.
No, Doug's a responsible adult.
Doug the lawyer, yeah.
The lawyer, right. No, I'm lucky enough to love teaching so much that even if I hit the lottery, I would teach two or three classes instead of five. And so I don't really go looking for work in this. If somebody says, hey, we're doing this thing and it sounds fun, then I'll say, hey, I would like to work on it. And if, you know, like if Wizards of the Coast showed up and was like, hey, you were a GM for a Red Death podcast that like four people listened to, and we're going to add the Red Death setting to Ravenloft. Would you work on that? Yes. And if they were taking pitches, I might pitch it. But one of the things that I realized after that first game, Gothic Doctor, was that I don't want to be a publisher. I don't want to do this full time. I just want to be able to do stuff when I say like, yeah, this seems fun. Let me work on this. Right. Like, Kids on Bikes was because I thought it would be fun to work with John, and it is, and I thought it would be fun to work on an RPG like this, and it has been, but not because I expected that it was going to cover expenses or pay bills. And that, as a hobby, is really important for me. And like John said, I'm really adamant about it.
Am I hearing correctly, Doug, that you have a work-life balance and professional boundaries that you employ as a freelancer?
Yeah, Doug's like the most mysterious unicorn I've ever met.
Majestic, too.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, balance is a strong word, but the summers off, I think, are the thing that allow me to do this, even as a hobby. Because then I can devote myself more to, you know, this summer it was, my focus was on Kids in Capes and one other secret project for Kids on Bikes, and a game called Home. Having that sort of headspace in addition to family life is something that the summers off affords me.
Yeah, it's something quite unique to the profession, I guess, that it does
that
go.
That you get holidays.
Yeah, that it comes in cycles like that. What about you, John? Obviously, you've got a completely different approach. What's it like designing games for a living? Is it precarious, or do you have a nice kind of niche that you sat in now?
It can be precarious, but it's also like I'm super happy to be in that precarious position, and I know that I'm really, you know, I know I'm really lucky to have gotten where I am. There definitely is a pressure, and the pandemic's made it worse because the global shipping crisis is just
eye-watering.
Yeah, it's just made the industry awful. And like, because I survive on, you know, quarterly income on royalties, like if ships don't make it for a quarter, like that's real bad for me. So it's definitely scary, but I wouldn't trade it for the world. I love it, and I try to balance. It's like, was it Matt Damon that said it in Clerks? Like, first you do the money movie and then you do the art movie. Like, I try to, you know, I try to alternate between projects that, you know, I think will make really good products and projects that I'm just super passionate about, which is, you know, what Kids on Bikes started out as, is just this passion project with Doug and I.
Where do you get your ideas? In the shower, in the bath, or on the bus?
In the spa?
Or do you kind of brainstorm and...
Yeah, I just lounge in the spa all day until...
The sauna.
The shower now, I was going to say, yeah.
I mean, a lot of it comes from the media that I consume. Like, Dead of Winter was because I grew up watching zombie movies. And none of the zombie board games were doing the things that I wanted to, that I thought were interesting about zombies. You know, Kids on Bikes was our ode to that genre. And, you know, I have a superhero game that I've been working on for years that's, you know, no other superhero game is doing the things that I want it to. So a lot of it comes from just trying to address what I think is missing from the market. And I don't know why, but I seem to have a very good skill at anticipating the zeitgeist in a lot of ways. Like, The Winner hit at the perfect time, and Kids on Bikes hit at the perfect time. So I'm very lucky in kind of, you know, getting excited about the things that people are going to be excited about in a year.
You're tapped into the right cultural vein. Is there a genre that you're really jazzed on? Maybe not right now, but it's just like, oh, I feel like one day I'd really love to make a game that explores that kind of genre or is inspired by that movie.
I've been really lucky. Teens in Space was both because the publishers wanted us to do Kids on Brooms as the follow-up to Kids on Bikes. And Doug and I were both like, oh, I would really like to do the space one. And they're like, yeah, then do the space one. That's fine. Do whatever you're excited about. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, Teens
in Space was the one that I was most excited about.
Why is that?
I love good sci-fi movies, and really Star Wars is a teens in space movie. Like, it was very much about kids on adventures with, you know, powers, and Guardians of the Galaxy too. So, you know, we had some really good kid for touchstones with it, and I was just really excited about making a spaceship and flying it around.
Yeah,
that sounded fun.
as we're wrapping up, is there anything that you would that's upcoming that you would like to plug? Anything you'd like to talk about?
Kids in Capes for sure. Something I would like to plug but can't.
Go on, do it. No, I'm kidding. No, of course, only what you're comfortable with.
Well, I've never seen Ivan angry, and I don't want to.
So what stage is Kids in Capes at the moment?
The early writing stages.
Right.
So we've got the ideas out there. We've generated those. Now we have to write them down and realize where all the holes are, and then either plug the holes or, you know, revise it so that the thing that has the hole in it isn't there anymore.
So we got a little wait for kids and capes.
Yeah,
is what you're trying to tell us.
Yes, I'll be fully honest. Yes.
Yeah.
But we can get hyped for it all the same.
Yeah.
I feel like you want to say something, but you can't.
I really, really, really do. One thing that I am really excited about is Free Content Friday, which is something that Hunters Entertainment does for some of their properties. This year, they're doing it for Outbreak Undead and Kids on Brooms. And this is the second year we've done it for the Kids Online. First year, it was sort of scattershot. And, you know, 1 month it was Kids on Bikes. And then 1 month it was a Teens in Space thing. And for this year, they said, we'd really like to do a unified thing. And so I edited and worked with 5 other really great writers to tell this year-long story about a school in Central Park, hidden in Central Park in New York City, where, well, things are starting to go awry at the school. I'm working on the final month that sort of brings the story to a close. And so I'm really excited for that and for people to see how that all turns out.
And where can people look for that when it comes out?
Yeah, so that's on DriveThruRPG. Everything, the first 11, the 11th month will go up tomorrow, November 5th, but it's on DriveThru. And if you look for stuff published by Hunters Entertainment and Free Content Friday, you'll find it there.
Fantastic.
Excellent. And you, Jonathan?
So, you know, obviously the Snallygaster situation, the Kids on Bikes board game, would love it if, you know, people checked out. You know, I think we did a good job of capturing some of the fun things about Kids on Bikes and a tabletop experience. And then early next year, I have a game coming to Kickstarter called CoLab, which is a board game about being a mad scientist who can't afford their own laboratory, so they have a co-working space.
Nice, lovely.
Oh, I feel that.
Yeah, we feel like the name CoLab is pretty clever because, you know, it's a co-working lab, and it's also a collaborative board game, and it's still competitive, but it's not cooperative. So like, you're trying to win, but everything you do, like, we're trying to take this game instead of take that. Like, you're constantly giving the other players stuff.
Excellent.
So it's a neat little take on worker placement games that I think has a lot of charm. And the art's fantastic in it. I'm in love with the art direction.
Who did the art?
An artist, Magdalena. I don't remember her last name. I'll have to look it up, but I have added her to my list of artists to work with again, because she's fantastic.
Oh, fantastic. And where can people find that?
That'll be on Kickstarter in January. So follow me on Twitter and I'll post it there, or, you know, just keep an eye on Kickstarter.
John mentioning Snallygaster reminded me. So Duel of Wands is a card game in the Kids on Brooms universe. A two-player heads-up, tactical, hand management, light deduction, filler game kind of thing that Luke Minch and I worked on in the Kids on Brooms universe. And really excited about art by Heather on that one throughout the game. Really, really love it.
Duel of Wands?
Duel of Wands, yeah.
Great.
It has mechanics for using it in the RPG as well, right, Doug?
It does, yeah. And Free Content Friday has an adventure centered around using it in there. So, yeah.
Ooh, fantastic. It's all tying together.
Multi-level marketing, right?
That's yes. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, first you get the game, then you get the tie-in, then you get the special Free Friday collaboration that ties it all together.
And then you get 10 friends and then you make them.
Then you get the monies.
That's right. One day.
Speaking of tying it together, I think Phil... You were about to our lovely guests.
I was going to thank you both very much for being here, despite the time differences and giving your insights on game design and this game in particular. We had an absolute blast playing it. If you're listening to this now and you just binged the whole season, thank you for at home as well for listening to it. I just want to say good luck in your future endeavors, guys.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, and thank you for having us. This was a pleasure.
It has been an honor to talk to you guys.
It's been great, and thank you so much. We got up early, but you stayed up very late for us.
Yeah, but we do that anyway. Well, that is all we have time for. Unfortunately, it has been so wonderful getting to talk to Doug and Jonathan. Oh my goodness. Thank you both so much for coming. I am Ellen, and I will relinquish my post as being GM. And Phil, would you like to sign off, but also tell us exactly what we're getting in store for next week?
Yes, thank you. We are beginning our season of The Witcher next week, so join us for episode 0 of The Blood-Soaked Rose. Thank you once again to Doug and Jonathan. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to Mystery Down Under, which is a Roll to Cast production. The best way to find us is on Twitter, Discord, and our Patreon. All our podcasts are on Acast, Spotify, YouTube, and all good podcatchers. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/RollToCast. Kids on Bikes and all associated properties are trademark of Renegade Game Studios. Used with permission.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to PrettyLitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.